Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I am joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing Secret Origins number 40, published in 1989. Sam, how are you doing tonight?
I am well. How are you, John?
I am doing well. Now, I want to talk a little about this series itself, just to kind of contextualize things before we get to the specific issue.
Sure.
This isn't the only volume of Secret Origins that DC has done. There was a one-shot back in, I think, 1961. A 7-issue volume or thereabouts in 1973. This volume that ran for, what, I think 50 issues, 3 annuals. And then there was another one after this in 2014 that went for 11 issues. So they've done quite a few, but what's interesting about this particular volume is it basically kicked in right after Crisis. So the purpose of this series was kind of reestablish, or in some cases just establish, the origins of various characters and teams in the new continuity. Now, ironically, they started out with Golden Age Superman, and I say ironically because, as they acknowledge in that story, he was, you know, now vanished forever into the oblivion of the antimatter universe of Crisis. I mean, they've just wiped out the character, and now they're starting with his origin. Kind of weird.
Which character? Wait a minute.
Golden Age Superman.
Oh, the Golden Age. Yes, 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 yes.
Now, technically, he didn't vanish forever into the oblivion of the antimatter universe, as we now know. But in 1986, that at least was the game plan. But I think that's the other thing that's, I don't want to say a hallmark of this series, but something you definitely have to contend with, is they had just shaken up the continuity big time. And the new continuity was still fairly fluid during the course of this series. And that's not to say it ever totally solidified. Matter of fact, I think this might have been when they told the origin of the Green Lantern Corps, and then a few months before or after, maybe in Green Lantern or something, they told a different origin of the Green Lantern Corps.
Of course.
It's just things were flexible, and that's going to happen in a shared universe. Now, this particular issue we picked because of the theme. I know you're a big Detective Chimp fan.
Yep.
This has 3 stories, 3 apes. Detective Chimp is the 3rd of those. Before that, we get Con Gorilla, and we start off with Gorilla Grodd. So, all apes, can't go wrong with that. Chimps, gorillas, whatever.
Yep.
So.
And we can discuss how much of any of those characters we got.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because, you know, looking at the cover, oh, Gorilla Grodd, that's our lead story. I get to it, and the story is titled The Secret Origin of Gorilla City.
Yeah, and I'm not 100% sure which physical representation was Grodd. I know who Solovar was.
Grodd was pretty clear there at the end.
Okay, yes, I agree with that. So is he the one that's kind of reddish the whole way through?
I think so.
Okay, and again, it's hard to tell if that's shading or...
Yeah, because in that final one, he seems kind of grayish, because I took him to be the one in the top center.
Wait a minute. No, isn't that Solovar who's speaking?
In the next panel.
Yeah, but wouldn't that still be Solovar?
I took that as a shot of the audience.
See, and again, that's... because the only clue we have to go on is the color, kind of. And from the very beginning, you get the red one, who you could argue is Grodd.
Actually, no, I don't think so. If you go... okay, first off, this is a different origin of Gorilla City than we had before Crisis.
Absolutely. No, and I would argue mostly after as well.
What did you think the origin of Gorilla City was?
I don't know, but I know I'm not familiar with this alien thing at all.
Yeah, the alien creature is new. Prior to Crisis, there's the story Solovar had told, but then there was the origin that was told in DC Superstars, where apparently Green Lantern had fought Gorilla Grodd before Flash had even met him in Gorilla City.
Okay.
But had forgotten all about that, and somehow Green Lantern had, like, towed this entire Gorilla City across space from another planet and just didn't know about it. It was very much a retcon, but, you know, whatever. That's what they were claiming. I don't think either origin has ever really gotten any kind of traction. in terms of
fair enough
being referenced later, whatever. But this one here with this alien one, if you go to that page where the two beams are coming out of that jeweled crystal thing,
which
this is just a couple of pages into the story.
Okay, I'm trying because I was looking at that and trying to figure it out.
Okay, there's the top panel where the one beam comes out, and then the panel in the next tier below that, kind of the center of the page, another beam comes out. And that second one, which is also a grayish-looking ape, at least in the copy I've got, is Grodd, because that's the warped, dangerous beam.
Then maybe So I don't know if we're looking at the same page. What's the dialogue on the page you're talking about?
It starts with, he was part child, part wizened elder.
Okay.
Some kind of alien gobbledygook.
Okay.
Though his language contained only the oddest of sounds, and then we kind of go to the flashback or whatever.
Okay, so
my copy doesn't have page numbers, otherwise I'd reference those.
Yeah, mine doesn't either. Yeah, I guess. So then the red one's completely irrelevant here.
Yep. But I had taken him as being Grodd in the story, too. It's just on a closer reading that, you know, we're finding out two concentrated beams came out of this thing.
Yes,
before.
The good one and the bad.
Yeah.
So at this point, we're now assuming the one to the left of the red ape is Sullivar, the first one that gets hit.
Yes.
And then the second one is Grodd.
Yes.
Okay.
Could it have been clearer storytelling? Absolutely.
Yeah, and then on the next page, that's clearly Sullivar, right? It's kind of watching them talk to the alien?
Yeah, I think so.
See, I don't know. And then the one where Sullivar's sitting there, that's clearly Sullivar.
That's clearly Sullivar.
But I'm not sure about the one in the second panel on that page, or third panel, I guess.
Third panel. That could be, because there that was could, mention of, well.
Yeah, that could be Grodd, could not be, could be Sullivar.
I don't think it was either. I think it, because there was, Sullivar mentions when he's learned English. That, you know, his mentor has gotten
Chemo
it.
Or whatever.
Chios or whatever.
Yeah, okay, fine. So it could be him.
Could be him. It's not to be speciesist, but they all look alike to me.
Yeah, of course. And then you've got the next page, which is all Sullivar and Chios, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
And then, so one of the things that's interesting here, again, it gets weird, because when the one turns on the other and kills the alien.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are coming after them, I'm assuming at that point, these are Grodd's guys.
I think they're just citizens who are upset that their alien benefactor has been killed.
Okay.
Because the whole basic overarching story here is it's a riff on the Superman origin. An alien child, maybe, lands on Earth.
Yep.
Found by gorillas instead of farmers.
Yep.
Has this jeweled sphere that seems to imbue the gorillas with intelligence.
Yep.
And Sullivar and Grodd a little bit more than others.
With these two beams, and you get the explanation of the good beam and the slightly distorted beam.
Yeah. And then when we get to that time jump to 1873 with the reporter interviewing the guy in the insane asylum,
yep,
who's the explorer that first discovered Gorilla City.
Who's the one of the two that lives in the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We find out that it was 11 years earlier that the alien landed.
Okay.
Gorilla City still being constructed at this time.
Yep.
And the alien's kind of in charge, but kind of imprisoned.
Yep.
He's been teaching the gorillas for 10 years. They destroyed his vessel about 9 years ago. Grodd's kind of been in hiding, kind of in plain sight, plotting to kill the alien because, well, you know, this story makes it seem like Grodd is evil as much because of what had happened to Grodd than really through anything of Grodd's fault.
Yeah, it's just kind of him and Sullivar both got, but he seems to have no power in Gorilla City and at least hasn't made it clear yet who he is.
He hasn't exerted political power or whatever, and he's certainly keeping a low profile.
Yes.
But he's got his mental powers because he's dominating the humans.
Well, yes. And then you've got the other thing that's interesting, and actually this took quite a bit of thought, and the synonym, antonym, speak of the alien, I actually think it's really well done. That took some clever thought and wordplay, and I thought it was pretty well done, and it gets the point across of, like you said, he's kind of their leader, but he's kind of their prisoner, and it does a very good job of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throne, cell, you know, the evades, drains, there's a bunch of. And every time he speaks, there's probably one in that word balloon, if not multiple.
there's definitely a sense of things getting lost in translation with the alien.
Yes.
No, absolutely. And I was reading this, again, expecting a Grodd story, getting a Gorilla City story, which I'm happy with. I love Gorilla City.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, again, if anything, I would have said this was a Solovar story more than anything, but okay.
Yeah, you could flip sides of the same coin to a degree, I think.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell a story about Gorilla City, Grodd, or Solovar without the other two being involved somehow.
Yep.
But it was one of those things, it's like, I remember none of this.
No. And
I read the issue when it came out. But it's like, it never got any kind of momentum behind it. And granted, Gorilla City kind of got pushed to the wayside when Barry Allen got pushed to the wayside and such. So it was used a few times here and there, because, I mean, Grodd would come back during the Wally West times and such. But the parallels to the Superman origin, I thought, were just surprising. And the time frame of the story, all of this happening back in the late 1800s.
Yep.
I mean, that puts Grodd, Solovar, and, like, most of Gorilla City well over 100 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know how long a gorilla usually lives, but that seems kind of excessive.
Fair enough. I don't know. I want to say it's in the 40 to 60 year range, but...
And I'm fine with the alien influence giving him longer life or whatever. It was just unexpected.
Yeah.
So, I thought this one was a fun story. Didn't go, you know, quite how I thought it would go, but it got to where it needed to get of how do we set up Gorilla City as a isolationist city yep. in the world, and it kind of ticked the right boxes there at the end.
Absolutely, and yeah, you've got a dissenter in the midst, Solovar's kind of in charge, and they're hidden.
Mm-hmm. So it definitely leads to where the city needed to be for when Barry had first discovered them.
Yes.
Which ironically is... I don't want to say kind of sort of what the other origin did, but it acknowledged the fact that none of that was known before Barry had heard his story from Solovar and such. So
yeah.
It comes a point where you've got a city like this, you've got a blank slate, you can pretty much say whatever the hell you want to say. And I would say this made as much or more sense as the other origin, or just, hey, they're smart apes in there, you know? This is probably the closest city DC has to Wakanda. A high-tech, hidden city. You know, in Africa.
Okay, fair enough. It's kind of its own thing. It is what it is.
Definitely, they're not carbon copies of each other.
Yeah, not even close.
There are some parallels, though.
Yeah.
This city clearly has much higher tech than the rest of the planet.
That does seem to be the case. But it's also got a bit of that that throwback Land of the Lost feel, even though there's no dinosaurs or anything. And why is, what's the Marvel place with all the dinosaurs and...
Savage Land.
Savage Land. I mean, it kind of is also their version of Savage Land in some ways. Not, again, perfect either.
Yeah, maybe, I guess. I mean, I'm not really seeing it, but I guess for me it's the high-tech city hidden behind an invisible screen or whatever. Screen.
Yeah, okay.
That gives it kind of the parallels. And again, a strong king leader and stuff like that.
Yep.
So... I really think there's more they could do and should do with Gorilla City than they have.
That I tend to agree.
But I thought this was a fun story.
Yep.
And, you know, big Flash fan, so definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too.
So what did you think of the Kong Gorilla story?
Okay, I've got to admit, of these three characters, Kong Gorilla is the one I know the least.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only reading I've done of Kong Gorilla is, boy... just before the New 52, if you remember, James Robinson took over Justice League.
Yeah, I was going to say, Justice League was, I think, where a lot of people are going to know him from.
And that's the only time I can remember really reading Kong Gorilla, which is only a few years, about 10 years ago from this point, and a mostly forgotten run in many ways.
I think I had read some of the stuff in, like, the digests.
Okay.
So I'd read some... I was going to say old stories, but old relative to where I was at the time, but not like, I don't know, maybe they were early Kong Gorilla stories. I doubt it, though.
Yeah.
I didn't particularly love the art in this, and I did think it was a little hilarious how they were kind of mixing gorillas of, you know, the ape variety with gorillas of the, you know, mercenary fighter variety. Because the whole story here... It starts at one point, and then it kind of flashes back and gets back to this point of a friend of Congo Bill has been killed by these militant guerrillas. You know, he gets left a ring, he accidentally triggers the magic ring, swaps with the golden gorilla's body or whatever.
Yep.
Has to go fight the gorillas to get back to his body to free the body. I mean, there's a couple of things that it's like, what are the odds? But the way the story is told, it kind of works.
It kind of does.
I'm not going to say it totally does.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of does.
Yeah. And this one had a bit more of a, I almost want to say, creepy thriller kind of angle to it. More almost not quite horror, but you know what I mean? Suspense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I don't want to say this is bad art, because even if these panels were drawn perfectly, I'm not sure. I don't think the turn when, what's his name? What is that guy's name?
The nephew?
The nephew, when he attacks Bill,
mm-hmm.
is not very clear in the art.
Where he's throwing the grenade in and leaving him trapped in the cave-in in the cave?
Is it a grenade? Is it a rock? Is it...
In what I got, it looked pretty clearly to be a green grenade.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Now that you say that, I see it, but I did not, when I was first looking at it kind of hard trying to figure it out, I just thought it was a green rock, or a rock with maybe the shadow because of the blue and...
If you know what it is, you know what it is, but if you don't, I can definitely see being a little confused.
Yeah.
Because it's in three panels, and the first two, all you've got is the motion trail and not the object itself.
Exactly.
So,
okay, so that's an I couldn't tell if he threw a rock and hit him in the back of the head with it, or... But, okay, I guess that's the explosion. Okay.
Yeah, the red panel is apparently the explosion.
Got it. Okay.
There are some places here where the storytelling definitely could have been better.
Yes.
So, I mean, it had the mood kind of thing right. Not necessarily right for the story, but in terms of things that go bump in the night kind of a story.
Mm-hmm.
But having the nephew of the guy who gets killed be the leader of the militant guerrillas, which is why the uncle was killed and all this stuff, it was a little kind of, you know, convenient Congo Bill just happened to be there at the time and whatnot. But in terms of setting a mood and kind of going with it and stuff, it was definitely interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, I will say one of the things, I read this in the single issue format, the letters page was really informative, particularly on the Congo Bill stuff.
Oh, good, because, see, I don't have that, so that might have been useful.
Congo Bill first appeared in Action Comics 37, the original Action Comics 37.
Yeah.
So June 1941. The Golden Gorilla first appeared in Action Comics 244, January 57. And then Congo Bill became Congorilla, where he'd, you know, take over the body of the Golden Gorilla, about 2 years later in Action Comics 248, which was January 1959.
So for those first 15 years, Congo Bill was just an adventurer?
He was one of the many safari adventurers in comics.
Got it. Okay.
You know, that was back when exploring the world apparently was still a thing.
Well, yeah. I see that, yeah.
So he had a definite, you know, set of adventures as just Congo Bill. Golden Gorilla had at least an adventure before the two met, and they'd been kind of linked ever since. That having been said, other than James Robinson pulling him into the Justice League for a bit, it's not like the character got a ton of use during, like, the 80s, 90s, and whatnot.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It was one I was aware of, but probably as much from back issues and occasional guest appearances here and there or whatnot. Was never kind of, you know, again, making him a Justice Leaguer, kind of surprising.
Yeah, that was an interesting group. I actually liked it, but I can understand how it was an interesting group.
It was definitely an interesting group, some unexpected choices or whatnot, but it worked. Mm-hmm. And it clearly didn't go as long as he thought it was, because his last issue, Robinson's, was kind of a series of pinups of here's all the stories I had planned to tell you but didn't get the chance.
Yes.
Which was kind of fun.
And one of the first times we saw something like that, which unfortunately is fairly common these days.
Yeah. What I think was good about this story, even though, again, I didn't really care for the art style, was it had more of a supernatural bent to it. It's not like they tried to explain the how the ring worked or anything like that. It just did.
Nope.
And putting that between the Grodd story and the Detective Chimp story, I felt was good, because if those two had been back-to-back, it would have been, this is familiar. Because Detective Chimp, we start with aliens come to Earth. And I'm like, again? you know? And in this case, they're going to enhance a native's brain so it may, quote, contemplate its existence in this cold, empty universe.
Yes.
I'm like, okay, sure. I don't know why you want to do that, but okay. Apparently not the first planet these aliens have tried to do this on, but the last 8 planets, the natives didn't quite survive the experience. And there was an aspect of the story that was definitely playing a little fast and loose and a bit comedic.
Yes.
I mean, the aliens are K-Ram and Wynad, or however you want to pronounce them.
Yep.
Which is basically anagrams for Mark and Andy, which, you know, were like the writers.
Well, okay, so here is what's interesting. Where is it? It's listed somewhere.
It is listed somewhere. Oh, it's Mark Badger for the art, Andy Heffler for the plot, and Mark Wade was the editor. So Andy and Mark were the writer and the artist.
Now, see, what's interesting is it actually lists Rusty Wells as the script.
Yeah, but Andy was the plot and tardiness.
Well, what's interesting is somewhere I found that Rusty Wells was a combined pen name for Mark Wade and Dan Rassler.
Oh, that's funny.
Who is not listed on, Dan Rassler's name's not listed anywhere on here.
No, but it could be that this was coming in late and Mark just had to...
had to get it done, exactly.
Yeah, and that would, yeah, that's interesting. That's funny. What I thought was funny is also, these aliens apparently are like microscopic.
Yes, which, yes, it's not until you see them get swallowed that you realize that.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of, you know, fun and whatnot. Again, why they picked this chimp and how they were augmenting him and stuff. Again, this was a little kind of happy-go-lucky, fast and loose, humorous sort of a story in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
The chimp gaining intelligence. Okay, he encounters some explorers. Sure, why not? Finds a mystery book, apparently learns how to read it on his own. But he's got massive intelligence. I'm assuming they not only boosted his intelligence, but like preloaded his brain with some stuff.
Well, I can't tell exactly what... is the thought balloons his sentience, obviously. The question is, can he think? Can he not communicate because he has an issue with his vocal cords, or can he not communicate for a different reason?
I don't know. That I was kind of confused by, because he could clearly think in English.
Yep.
Complete with, like, you know, faster than speeding bullets, references to Superman even.
Yep.
Yet he can't speak. I don't know if it's just because he hasn't tried, if he's unable to. I don't know when in the original comics he gained the ability to speak.
And clearly, again, the English works because he can pull the book out and basically underline words and go, I want to say this, you know.
Mm-hmm. He's communicating as if he's mute, but it's basically, you know, right here, read this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So there were aspects that were funny and that worked or whatnot, but there was also a, if you think too hard about it, your brain's going to hurt.
No, I thought it was cute. I loved it. The only part I didn't love... well, one, it's not really a detective chimp story.
No.
Fair, in any way, shape, or form.
It's a precursor at best.
At best. And the crime itself makes no sense, particularly from the Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes vein of mysteries. This is just kind of a random serial killer. This nonsense about wanting the other guy's job is pointless.
Well, yeah.
You don't kill random people. This guy's just a serial killer. He's not killing a guy for a job. That's not the way that would work.
Well, he says he does.
Yes.
But I agree, the logic of the crime makes no sense.
Yeah, again, yeah, this guy's just a serial killer. There's no he did it to get the job. That makes zero sense.
Well, and there's also no indication what clues Detective Chimp apparently saw to give him that brilliant insight.
Well, he saw the murder.
Yeah, but he's thinking at the end, this guy wants your job. What? Why? How? I mean, sure, he's a killer.
Yes, okay. You're right. Yes. How Detective Chimp or anyone else makes the leap to he wanted your job, I have no idea. But the Detective Chimp just didn't solve anything. He literally saw him kill someone and went, oh,
yeah,
that's the killer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this... I was expecting and hoping for more for Detective Chimp origin than we got here.
Yes, especially as we pointed out, one written by Mark Wade.
Scripted,
whatever.
Well, to me, that's a key difference. I think the plot and the art was done, and he had to basically put dialogue on the page to make it work.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
So that may not have been what the original intent was for the story?
Fair enough. Which, because that, his own piece of art that the chip makes when he first makes no sense.
It almost looked like Blue Beetle.
It does. And he appears to be in bars. He doesn't look anything like the killer, so you can't say he's trying to draw that this guy belongs in prison.
I took it as he drew it like on the side of a box or something, and that's what the vertical bars are.
Okay, fair enough. That may or may that makes as much sense as not, but
yeah, there's nothing to say that's definitely what the case is, but that's how I took it.
And that makes sense. But the point is there's nothing to say he's just a random artist as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, before he reads them, you know, why? Why draw that guy? Who is that guy?
Yeah, it was a little perplexing in places.
Yes.
And this is one where the art style was a lot more cartoony almost than I tend to care for.
Yes, I don't mind cartoon, but this was very scratchy.
It was a loose style.
It was a very loose style. And in many ways, the huge expressions, the giant expressions, it reminds me a lot of manga in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But an earlier version, I mean, it certainly doesn't look like modern manga, but it looks closer to that style than more traditional comic style.
It's got manga style storytelling techniques.
Yes.
But almost comic strip kind of art.
Yeah.
You're not going to look at it and think, oh, it's manga. When you mention that, it's like, yeah, I definitely see some of the manga techniques being used here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we may have to find some better examples of some Detective Chimp stuff to do at some point.
Sure.
So, because this was not anything that I would say is classic Detective Chimp.
That I agree with.
But the sad thing is, at this point, it was basically the definitive origin of the character post-crisis.
Yep.
And it's not like the character had gotten a lot of use at that point, because it wasn't until... I'm trying to think what series he really came back in. What was the one with all the magic users or whatnot?
Well, that was the Justice League Dark,
Before that, even. There was a Bill Willingham series, and I'm blanking on the name.
That wasn't the one on Earth 10, was it?
No. It was on the main Earth. It had a lot of the ones from the Oblivion Bar and stuff in it.
Shadow Pact,
that's the one I was thinking.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
That was really, I think, one of the times he kind of came back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, he was definitely part of Shadow Pack.
And he'd get used a couple of other times, a couple of other places. But again, there was a long stretch where he had been published but wasn't being used. You know, I would say for most of the 70s, 80s, and 90s at least, he might get an occasional reference or appearance, but he was not any kind of ongoing concern at DC.
Shadow Pack was that great, interesting group, too.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of characters that kind of have disappeared. Well,
kind of, sort of, but I think it's also kind of, sort of, what at least led into things like Justice League Dark.
Yep.
Demon Knights. It was kind of the, let's take some of our magical people and try them as superheroes, sort of.
Yeah.
But not quite, you know?
Well, because they really started, wasn't that what they did with Blue Devil? Wasn't Blue Devil kind of their leaders, I remember?
I'm trying to remember. It's been long enough since I've read it.
You had the Enchantress and Ragman and Detective Chimp, I seem to remember.
Who was the guy with the sword?
Is that Zuriel?
No. It was a blue or black suit or whatever, or costume.
Because I do remember, I think Zuriel was in there. But no, she was like an angel with a sword.
Yeah. No, this was not him. I used to be able to remember this sort of thing. I don't know what happened. I mean, they keep, you know, revamping their continuity, so it's almost a losing game.
You know, that is true, too.
But...
And we're going back two continuities, at least.
At least. But they had... what was her name from the Charlton characters?
Nightshade, right?
Nightshade, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think what the guy with the sword's name was. I just don't remember.
Yeah, me neither. I don't... I said there was the angel, the demon... And I think they had the Enchantress.
I'm pretty sure they had Blue Devil. Definitely had Ragman.
Yeah.
But then it was... Because they killed off the guy with the sword. And that kind of bummed out Chimp for a while.
Yeah. Well, and that was... I'm trying to remember. That was all in that... Oh, you had the Spectre there at the start. Because didn't that start with Day of Vengeance, wasn't it? Going into Infinite Crisis?
I don't remember.
I think that's where they started.
I thought it was one where it was Phantom Stranger kind of leading him around.
It might have been.
Again, it was one that, you know, interesting kind of use of some of the characters that were a little harder to fit into other books. But, I mean, one of the things I enjoy about, you know, Secret Origins is it allowed them to, after they just massively, you know, scrambled their continuity, it gave them a place to kind of reestablish some characters. You know, are you familiar with Firestorm? Let's give his origin. Or, you know, the different Blue Beetles and such. You know, they went through different teams, a lot of different characters. They usually did 2, maybe 3 stories per issue.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, they were trying to do a lot of Golden Age stuff, but I think they ran to a point where it's like, yeah, they were kind of out of the top tier and the second tier ones for that. And they, for some of the annuals, they did, like, the Doom Patrol, the original, and then the then-new Doom Patrol. This is before what most people would currently think of the Doom Patrol, oddly enough.
Well, and I believe the very next one published after the one we just covered was the third annual, which was a George Perez-written 80-page giant with all the Titans.
I was going to suggest that I could probably be talked into doing that at some point.
Absolutely.
It's got a great cover. And he wrote it and whatnot, so yeah. And it covered, as I recall, a fair amount of their history at the point. So, yeah, it definitely had some fun stuff. Some of them were a little more better executed than others, but that's going to be the case for any 50-issue series, particularly an anthology series like this.
Without any kind of, just whoever either wanted or they could hire to do it month to month.
Yeah. I think the closest it came to having any kind of, I don't say continuity, but thread throughout, was they did a stretch where they started with the Justice Society, the next issue did the Justice League, and then I think the next 3 did various members of the then Justice League.
That makes sense.
So it gave it at least some cohesiveness from issue to issue. But definitely had some fun stuff, you know, and they would do occasional theme issues like this. I think they did one on a Secret Origin of the Bases. They did, I think, the Happy Harbor Cave for the Justice League, the Legion Headquarters, and Titan's Tower, I think. So they definitely, you know, thought out of the box on some of this stuff. And again, I don't know if Mark Waid edited the entire run. He certainly did this issue. But man, what a perfect guy to do this kind of a title.
Yes.
Fairly encyclopedic knowledge of the DC universe and whatnot, and a good sense of storytelling and knowing when things should, you know, maybe not be what they were. So definitely an interesting issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And just flipping through some of the earlier issues, I mean, it looks like, but that's true because he just put his name on everything. It looks like John Broome and Carmine Infantino are listed as the editors on the vast majority of the series.
Okay, that may be. I'm trying to think who were the kind of powers to be at that point.
But there's a rather lengthy list of kind of individual issue editors that's just as random as the other creative members.
Yeah, I don't know how they divvied up the work on this. Because I could definitely see for, like, the couple issues for the Justice League, well, you ought to have that come out of the Justice League office.
Yeah.
So.
Well, those 2 guys, heck, they were there and wrote most of the original origins, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or at least had been there, even if they didn't write the originals. They'd been there and dealt with them for 30 years at that point.
If I were to take over DC, which of course is never going to happen, but if it were to happen, I would do some kind of rejiggering of the continuity, because I think it's in a sad state as it is. And I could definitely see doing a Secret Origins series. But I would be tempted to give it a through line with having some kind of governmental investigative group that's trying to get the backstory on these people.
Mm.
Whether that would be Checkmate or an international group or whatever. Then there's the question of, well, what do they do with that information? And probably just sit on it for later use. But you'd need something, I think, to give it a little bit of cohesiveness and to make it kind of relevant.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think anthologies like this would sell today.
It depends. Again, I've read a lot of bad anthologies in the last 15 years. That being said, I've read some really good anthologies over my life. That, heck, I mean, I read Dark Horse Presents for probably a decade straight and loved them.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a knee-jerk reaction by many comic fans. Oh my god, anthologies, I hate them all. No. Some of them just aren't very well done, or they aren't working for you, or the price point's not right, or whatever. But I don't think that means the concept of an anthology is a bad idea.
I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it has some inherent logistical hurdles to overcome. The inconsistency of quality, tone, style, and stuff when you don't have a single lead continuing through the book, or necessarily a creative team continuing through the book. And you can forego one of the two, but when you get rid of both, you start to have problems.
Well, and I do think that, and you know, it's been around for 30, 40 years at this point, the uber focus on creative teams, I think, makes marketing anthologies harder now than it once was.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced comics are better for it either.
No, I think you could do a Secret Origin sort of a thing. At Marvel, you'd need a different title, of course, but with a consistent creative team, if you had the right creators, if you had a Kurt Busiek, a Mark Waid, a Geoff Johns, and there's only a handful of people that have the kind of knowledge you would need to be able to do an ongoing series in either the Marvel or DC universe, where month after month after month, they're telling kind of the definitive origins of you know, everybody over time.
Yeah, I guess my point is you don't need consistency.
I think from a marketing reality yes. point of view, you do.
Yes. For a new modern, yeah, yes. That, sadly, I agree with that. I don't think it's made the experience or the stories that much better.
No, I don't think so. And certainly back in the 80s, you could have, you know, rotating characters, rotating creative team, and get a 50-issue series out of it.
Exactly.
But I think we also saw in this particular issue, some of the stories were not brilliant.
Oh, these? No, I don't think this was a great issue. I'm not going to argue it well.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I remember when the first issue of this came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it might have been the very first number one I ever had. And it was like Batman's Rogues Gallery.
That was a special.
Was it?
Yeah, because the first issue was the Golden Age Superman.
Was it? Okay. I remember having that one. I want to say Alan Grant did it originally, and it was like Batman's Rogues Gallery. Was that not the first issue?
That was not the first issue. That was a special. I think that was done in a later year, even. I think that was around the time of this issue.
Oh, might have been. Okay.
Because, again, that first issue was the Golden Age Superman.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense.
And just the irony of we're going to be telling you the definitive origins of characters, and we're going to start with one that we just wiped out. Kind of funny, but kind of appropriate to start with that character because he started everything.
Yeah.
What's funny is I don't know that they ever circled around to the then current Superman unless they did it later in that issue, but I don't know.
But that would have been, what, 86?
Yeah. Well, you would have just had Man of Steel.
Man of Steel was coming out. Why would you bother?
Yeah. Yeah. But even by the end of the series, which would have been
early 90?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably sometime in 1990. That sounds about right. Probably still no need, because, yeah. But again, they covered Legionnaires, they covered Golden Age characters, they covered teams that were somewhat obscure at the time. A couple of characters that I don't think were all that old at the time, such as Blue Devil.
Yeah.
So, but also some classic ones like the original Warlord.
Yeah.
And they did the Suicide Squad, both the original version and the then current version.
Okay.
You know, and then they did another one where they did Zatar and Zatanna. So they had a couple where the two halves made sense together, and a few others where they absolutely made no sense whatsoever together, but, you know, hey, that works too. I think they had one of the best covers ever with the issue that covered the Legion of Substitute Heroes and Dr. Light. On the cover, it had them trapped in the three-way light bulbs of death.
Oh, yeah, 37.
Yeah.
That is a great cover.
So, definitely some fun stuff.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think I'm good.
Cool.
Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website.
The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next preview spotlight.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. thanks for listening.